Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. On March 20th, 2024, the Reagan Institute held its second annual National Security Innovation-Based Summit in Washington, D.C. The event convened prominent thought leaders, current and former public officials, investors, and representatives of the most innovative industry and technology companies to discuss the important issues facing our annual National Security Innovation-Based ecosystem. The program also unveiled the second iteration of its groundbreaking National Security Innovation-Based Report Card, which measures the health, effectiveness, and resilience of this ecosystem and provides recommendations for improvement. The program's keynote was the Honorable Kathleen Hicks, the 35th Deputy Secretary of Defense. Technology sits at the heart of national security competition. Adversaries pour massive amounts of state-directed funding into their efforts, and they lack key ingredient that has propelled the U.S. leadership since our founding: dynamism of free and open systems enriched by American ingenuity. In the face of these challenges, and to maximize our strength, what our nation needs is a strategist who also has deep experience converting strategy into the defense program. In her role at the Pentagon, she has made innovation a central focus rather than a side project. Following the Deputy Secretary of Defense's remarks, she sat down in conversation with Reagan Institute Director Roger Zackheim. Let's listen.
Thank you to Rachel, and good afternoon to everyone here. I really want to just tell you that by hosting this summit, the Reagan Institute is doing an incredible job helping to bring attention to the importance of the defense industrial base, which is a mission I think we can all get on board with. Whether in DoD or Congress or beyond, we all have a responsibility to foster a broad national security innovation base. New entrants are vital to that mission, but so too is the health of longstanding partners in the defense industrial base. And I often speak to the former, but today I'd like to focus some of my remarks on the latter. So to all of those of you who build things primarily for the military or even that only the military needs, I want to say thank you. And we need you in our innovation base, from aircraft carriers, destroyers, and nuclear submarines to stealth bombers, tanks, and troop carriers and machine guns, missiles, and more. And I'm not only talking about the prime contractors, that so often serve as our large system integrators. I'm also talking about the thousands of sub-tier suppliers, many of them small businesses in communities all over America. The military and the industrial base are mutually dependent. Without warfighter demand and taxpayer dollars, the U.S. defense industry as we know it could not exist. And without the capabilities that industry provides to support America's security, then America as we know it would cease to exist. So we're in this together. Because wars are fought by militaries, but they are won by nations. Now, part of being a capitalist system means that businesses should be able to make a fair profit, provided that the customer is getting what they pay for. Indeed, as we've seen with the People's Republic of China, alternative systems are often rife with corruption, riddled with inefficiency, and better at stealing intellectual property than generating it. Because ingenuity and creativity thrive the most when they're enabled and surrounded by free minds, free markets, and free people, not when they're forced to toe the party line. In the context of this system, the U.S. defense industrial base has typically traced the ebb and flow of peacetime and wartime, mobilizations, demobilizations, buildups, surges, and peace dividends. A key trend today is disruption. A new generation of defense tech startups and scale-ups. And that's welcomed. We should all welcome that, because competition is good for the taxpayer and good for the warfighter, too. Think about it. If you're downrange in some austere location, under fire from dozens of one-way attack drones, you don't want just one type of system for counter-UAS. That's too risky. You want as much protection as you can get. So we want roadrunners and coyotes, for instance. We want to see more market competition for defense dollars, more small businesses and suppliers pioneering solutions that can make a difference for the warfighter, more companies that want to work with us, whether for the first time or after doing so for a long time. And we should expect to see more opportunities for all of that to come together, even within the scope of a single program. For example, this month, the Army awarded a software company the prime contract for a hardware-intensive program focusing on fusing and disseminating sensor data across domains. That alone may be a first, but allow me to highlight what happened at the subprime level. It brought together a mix of traditional and non-traditional defense companies, from Sierra Nevada to Northrop Grumman to Anduril. Hopefully, such teamwork is a harbinger of things to come, and hopefully we'll see the power of continuous, iterative development of software and hardware to accelerate capability delivery. At the very least, we need everyone designing and building their systems from the ground up to play well with others, leveraging modular open system architectures to be not only interoperable, but also interchangeable, so we can more rapidly integrate emerging technology. And we mean this both internationally and domestically. Under AUKUS, for example, we've worked with Congress to make it easier for our defense industrial base to work closely and collaboratively with industry in Australia and the United Kingdom. Today, America's defense industrial base is at a pivotal moment, and not just because of the new kids on the block. The COVID pandemic revealed how fragile and brittle supply chains had become. The war in Ukraine has revealed how nation-state aggression is a real threat, requiring information age ingenuity and industrial era capacity. And the need to modernize and stay ahead of our pacing challenge reveals how the DIB has been affected by decades of yo-yo dieting, inconsistent funding, and blinkered demand signals. Together, our task is to deliver combat-credible capabilities to the warfighter at speed and scale so they can deter aggression and win if called to fight. But the truth is, the engines of production never spin up from 0 to 60 overnight. In President Reagan's time, we could tolerate years and decades-long timelines when our main strategic competitor was relatively slow and lumbering. However, this is not the Cold War or the post-Cold War era. With the PRC, we are in a persistent generational competition for advantage, and we have to double down with urgency and confidence. That's why the Biden-Harris administration's focus on American innovation, manufacturing, and production has been so important for national security. Because our military strength depends in part on our overall economic strength here at home. So we've made serious, significant, and sustained investments across now 4 annual defense budget and multiple supplemental funding requests to Congress to strengthen the health, workforce, supply chains, viability, and productivity of the U.S. defense industrial base, short-term and long-term. To help prime the pump, our investments since this administration's first defense budget request have included $2.4 billion for casting and forging batteries, kinetic, and critical materials. $10.3 billion in microelectronics, augmented by historic funds in the CHIPS and Science Act. $12.9 billion for industrial-based infrastructure and facilities, including shipyards. $9 billion alone in submarine industrial-based investments to support both our domestic production goals and AUKUS commitments. And $24.7 billion for multi-year procurement of key munitions from Patriots to long-range anti-ship missiles. In fact, the budget that we released last week for FY25 increases LRASM procurement quantities by over 70% compared to FY24, taking advantage of newly expanded production capacity. Of course, we're investing in many other areas as well, from quadrupling production of 155mm artillery shells to expanding co-development, co-production, and even co-sustainment with key allies and partners. Our procurement budget has been consistently more than our R&D budget. We buy a lot of things, $167.5 billion in procurement requested in our fiscal 2025 budget. All of these investments and more have been aligned with the needs of our national defense strategy and the national defense industrial strategy that builds upon it. The latter, which we released in January, is the first of its kind in DoD, born of a recognition that our defense industrial base is something we must actively and strategically shape to meet this generational strategic moment. Because production matters. Production is deterrence. Now, the military may be a singular customer for the defense industrial base, but we are not a unitary actor. We have to succeed through teamwork with both industry and Congress. And while I believe we all agree on the urgency to innovate, I must say one of the most serious obstacles to doing so has been the lack of stable, predictable, timely funding. For the 11th time since I became Deputy Secretary, DoD is operating under a continuing resolution, and we look to be headed toward a 12th time. As many here know, these stopgap measures are really half measures. They inhibit us from starting new programs. They compress our time to do talented acquisition work with our professionals who have to award contracts, ensuring taxpayer investments are safeguarded. And they rob us of critical momentum, forcing us to stand still while Beijing, Moscow, and Tehran move to modernize their militaries, coerce their neighbors, and work to outpace us. Shutdowns are even more damaging. So we need Congress to pass bipartisan FY24 appropriations as soon as possible. We're almost 6 months into the fiscal year, so it's long overdue, and the delay has already been devastating. It wasn't always like this. For all 8 years of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and even when Roger's father was DoD comptroller in the early 2000s, DoD, on average, spent 45 days a year under CRs, about 6 weeks. Not great, but doable. Some years it was less. But over the last 3 years, that number has more than tripled. DoD has operated under CRs for an average of 143 days a year. Since 2010, we've lost nearly 5 years in total to CRs. No amount of money can buy that time back. It's impossible to compete and outcompete the PRC with one hand tied behind our back 3, 4, 5, or 6 months of every fiscal year. Washington has to do better, and I know it's possible. Just think, for 7 presidential election years in a row, 1984, 88, 92, 96, 2000, 2004, and even 2008, Congress passed DoD's base budget before Election Day. We hear the right words, but actions matter most. In Congress, industry, and even in the Pentagon, we need everyone to set aside differences, come together, and work together around our shared recognition that we are in a generational era of strategic competition with the PRC. And central to that competition is investing to take care of our troops and their families. Let me get to a concluding message. To have a healthy, resilient, dare I say, thriving American arsenal of democracy, we also need a healthy, resilient, and thriving American democracy. The two cannot be separated because enforcing contracts and protecting IP depends on upholding the rule of law. Hiring a talented workforce depends on good schools and universities and immigration. The prosperity of all Americans depends on ensuring equal rights and equal opportunity for all. And starting a business, investing in others, inventing a product and taking it to market depends on safeguarding the institutions that provide the blanket of liberty under which you do so. If we want to keep changing the world, then we have to strengthen the democratic principles that make this nation so worth defending and make changing the world even possible. Our country is not immune to the authoritarian winds that sweep the globe. We have seen America routinely tested, and while she has withstood, we cannot take that for granted. Institutions can be degraded, belief in institutions can fade. Both endanger the health of our nation and our industry's success. We want private sector innovation to succeed. We need the private sector to feel the same about American democracy, because neither can thrive unless the other survives. How we do this matters. Our ends and our means for achieving them are intertwined, because the end we seek is for American democracy and industry to continue to long endure. I want to thank all of our workers across the defense industrial base. American ingenuity and hard work are why U.S. military equipment is the best in the world and why foreign military sales requests continue to increase to all-time highs. You will remain one of our greatest enduring advantages long into the future. 40 years ago this fall, then-President Reagan visited Palmdale, California, and spoke to some of the many defense industry workers building the B-1 bomber and secretly multiple stealth aircraft. There, he recalled a pledge he'd made a few months earlier at Omaha Beach: to always remember, to always be proud, to always be prepared, so that we may always be free. And he said there was no higher responsibility than to honor that pledge, because no one, absolutely no one, should ever ask the sons and daughters of America to protect this land with less than the best equipment that we can provide. That responsibility guides us still today, and it always must, and it always will. Thank you.
More from our keynote address with the Honorable Kathleen Hicks after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now back to our program with the Honorable Kathleen Hicks.
Secretary Hicks, it's a pleasure to have you back at the Reagan Institute. And thank you for invoking Ronald Reagan and Dov Zakheim's tenure as comptroller.
I didn't even see him there. Hi, Dov.
There we go. Check that, both boxes. That's great. I can go to the family dinner next week. Really interesting. Well, I want to react to your remarks, and really interesting kind of entry into this discussion on the innovation base by talking about the defense industrial base. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if before February of 2022 that might have happened. But I think it makes a lot of sense. And part of the discussions we've had today, and I know you were trying to track that as you were also trying to track the progression in the GOP conference discussions today, is talking about transforming our military capabilities for tomorrow. Autonomy is the obvious one to speak to. Mm-hmm. But then there's also what you're describing about the industrial base to take the platforms we have today and innovating on them as well. Reflect on your tenure, now as Deputy Secretary, in terms of how you've kind of shaped your thinking about innovation in both of those areas: the today problems, which you're managing perhaps more than you wanted to, and then the tomorrow challenges, which of course you've always been focused on.
I think the biggest takeaway I could give you is that the answers are yes and. Mm. And any attempt to simplify to some kind of silver bullet system, fix to the system, those will fail. We have needs across the department that are vast and that fall all across the spectrum: software, hardware, everything in between, and most importantly, integration of all of that. So the way in which we interface, who we interface with to get that, the researchers university communities, to private companies, to large companies, small companies, traditional, non-traditional. To some extent, these, you know, start to lose their meaning after a point as distinct groups, because we're a reflection of the overall U.S. economy. We have very specific needs, which I spoke to here, and then we have very common needs, and we can leverage a lot of what's in the commercial sector. So I think the big takeaway, if you will, is it's yes and, we need all of the above. And too often I think people go to those sectors and their communities rather than thinking holistically about how do we bring down barriers across the system.
And one of the remarkable things that we've seen, and you referenced this in your remarks, you referenced the Titan program, not sure by name, but this idea how you have new entrants actually working with the traditional primes.
Yep.
I'm curious if that is something that's happened organically from where you sit, or has that been something you've been kind of pounding heads? You know, when Ash Carter started DIU, My imagination of that conversation is he probably brought both sides in and said, okay, work together, and each side said, pound sand. You know, they're gonna squash me. That's what the new entrants would say, and the prime would say, well, these guys just want to go public. They don't want to work with us. Mm-hmm. Why is it happening now?
I think there's some necessity is the mother of invention in there. The types of capabilities that are evolving in the outside of defense realm are so clearly applicable to our needs, particularly in software, that it's very encouraging. You know, I think the traditionals, if I could maybe speak on their behalf, see the value in bringing them in. For the non-traditionals, we've really seen a sea change. I don't know how much you all have already talked about this today, in terms of the desire to work with the department. And I think there the PRC's done the heavy lifting. Mm. The heavy lifting is in their actions. Folks saw what happened, for instance, for Hong Kong. They've seen the aggressive advances in their military modernization. They've seen the threat to Taiwan. You know, so they've seen the theft of, at a much more, you know, as I mentioned in my remarks, at a much more company level, they've seen the stealing of intellectual property, right. the cyber intrusions, things of that sort. So whatever those reasons are, we are absolutely thrilled that folks want to work with us. We want to throw those doors wide open as we can. We know we are very challenging for folks to work with, and that's part of my job and the job of other leaders in the department is to try to find ways to lower those barriers.
One of the quote you had in your speech was a reference to the National Defense Industrial Strategy. It says, mm-hmm. production is deterrence. I think is spot on. Mm-hmm. And I know Bill, your colleague Bill LaPlante has been saying the same. But one of the elements that came into this report card was looking at that and saying, okay, well, the program of record is the coin of the realm. I don't know if you agree with that, but generally, okay, so we'll give you an opportunity to tell me why in just a moment. And I guess the question is that explain, you know, why that is or not the case, because so many feel that they can't get to that program of record, and therefore they can't produce, mm-hmm. right? If production is a deterrence and people want to produce, mm-hmm. but they're not getting there because they can't penetrate into an existing program of record or see, mm-hmm. you know, a new one come out. All right, Kath, take it down.
No, I want to listen and be open to the way in which those who are trying to enter into our market, you know, believe they can show value back to those who've invested in them. So I take that. I do think program of record is a sort of 20th century way to think about the way in which we are investing in capability.
We like the 20th century here at the Reagan Institute. So you know.
wasn't so bad.
Now it's getting personal.
I mean, I think the reality is that the way in which we feed the warfighter capability goes well beyond programs of record. Obviously, the adaptive acquisition pathways with Ellen Lord sitting right here is a huge way in which, you know, that had already begun to transform several years ago. We are building on that. Software acquisition is a clear other example, whether through the pathway formally or other approaches, OTAs, et cetera. That said, production does matter. And so I just don't know that I would equate all production with programs of record. I also think that, you know, those who've worked with the DoD a long time, particularly the traditionals, I was saying the other night, they've built up their calluses, you know. And I think for those who are newer working with us, that's it's tough. I mean, you know, we're not the easiest to work with, and I can see where there's a desire to get to program of record as the measure of performance or their measure of success. And I think we have a lot of work to do to make us easier to work with for them.
A lot of discussion today referenced this thing called Replicator.
Yeah.
Have you heard of it?
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
I have.
But interestingly, I didn't hear it in your remarks.
Correct.
Okay. And so I would love for you to talk a little about Replicator, perhaps hitting on the following items. You know, when you spoke about it perhaps in, I guess, in August or so, it was this 12 to 18-month window.
Mm-hmm. 18 to 24.
Okay, you're right.
Good
I just wanted a timeline. I was looking for it. 18 to 24.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about attributable autonomous systems at scale, multiple thousands and multiple domains.
Yeah.
As you said, within the next 18 to 24 months. How are we doing? It's not something you're seeing in the budget request, as you told.
It is in the budget request.
But outline how we're doing against it.
Sure. So we are on plan. The 24 approach, we, like everyone, I think Mike McCord likes to say he's hitting refresh on his browser to see if we'll get the bill. We put in a reprogramming request that was very well received in all four corners off of our 23. That is still a viable pathway. However, we also are led to believe it's possibly in the 24 bill. So we need one of those two pathways to move forward. And our whole goal with Replicator really was to be listening, especially to the appropriators and their report language last year in both the House and the Senate, which was essentially work with what you have. You guys have a lot of authorities. You can come back and ask for reprogramming. You could even come back and ask for reprogramming under a CR. Let's play ball. And that is exactly what we have done in Replicator. So, you know, we need to see that come to fruition. They've been very positive about it, but of course we don't have a bill, and the reprogramming request, I think, continues to move through as an alternative path. So that's 24. We've built it into our budget for 25. And let me pause there to just say a little bit about what Replicator is. Replicator is a process inside the department. We learned from several other efforts that we've undertaken, RADR, everything's got a great name, right? RADR and CAP. So Replicator is the latest version of that, really focused on production. What we've learned is that when we can bring senior leader attention in a systemic way and look enterprise-wide at how to lower those barriers I talked about, we think we can create, really catalyze activity in capability areas that are important. So we know from warfighters that this area of attributable autonomy is very important to the concepts that they are building out, particularly as we look to INDOPACOM. We know how they want to apply the capabilities. We are about trying to get that capability into their hands as quickly as possible, and the multiple thousands and multiple domains in 18 to 24 months meets that INDOPACOM near-term requirement. It is not a substitute for autonomy for the Department of Defense. That is not the goal of Replicator. But it is going to show we're going to lower barriers, burn down risk across a whole panoply of challenge areas from requirements. This is why the vice chairman chairs it with me. The fact that we have just in the first 5 months that we had it moved through the requirements just alone, requirements process, got capabilities identified, got systems identified, got resources identified, that's knocking years off of the efforts where the department was headed already. But what will happen at the end of this process, when we've burned down the risk, when we've created these integrated capabilities, when we've provided it in a test environment to INDOPACOM and others, and when they've delivered and fielded, there's still the need across the department to better integrate autonomy, attributable or otherwise, into what the department is doing. That is a much broader challenge set where we think Replicator is a tool, not the only tool we're using, but a tool to get the services to start to get comfortable with the burn down of risk. Obviously, as is quite clear, I am bearing the risk on Replicator. I think it's a very good risk to take. If the Ukrainians and Russians can put out thousands of UASs every month, and we are having heart attacks over whether the Defense Department of the United States of America can put out multiple thousands over 18 to 24 months. If we can't do that, we have a much bigger problem than whether Replicator, you know, was
violent head nodding in
this
room.
Was a good success. Yes. And we say we want us to take risk. You know, this is a good example. Do we want us to take risk? Are folks on board for this? But the bigger transformation in the department, these senior level led pathfinders, I think, are incredibly important for changing culture. It's a show me culture. Show them that people are willing to take risks. Show them you'll put your reputation on the line to make change happen, and then maybe they'll make change happen. But the actual investment, that's going to be service centric, and the production engines are service centric.
We had Mac Thornberry, former chairman of the Armed Services Committee, here earlier today, may still be, and was praising Replicator and also noted how it is resting on the Deputy Secretary's shoulders. Seems like you're comfortable with resting your shoulders. That's great.
Yeah.
Last question before we open up to the audience here. And because you approach this, I know, from years prior to your current position through a strategic lens, the National Defense Strategy. You look overall, across the horizon, the strategy, the budget, the programs. There's a concern out there, I share this, that it's shrinking. The force is shrinking. Mm-hmm. And then we can't realize our strategic objectives, however mm-hmm. you want to manage it. And instead of being the force that can go ahead and dominate in three regions of the world and deter and, if necessary, prevail in conflict, we're actually going to have to make some choices here to the point where we're not going to be able to do it in all those places where we need to be, where the strategy says we need to mm-hmm. be. And you're managing the outcome of the Fiscal Responsibility Act. You didn't pass that. That was the president signed the bill that the Congress passed. But what can you do? Mm-hmm. You're working under the hood of the budget, but overall, the top line is driving you towards a smaller force. I think you can measure it, you know, whether it's by people, platforms, whatever. Give me your take on that and whether you view it differently.
Yeah, I think what I would say is our 24 budget request, which we very much hope to have enacted very soon, that budget request is matched to our strategy. It's built upon the NDS. And we think it does meet the ambitions of that strategy. The 25 cap being imposed for 25 at the FRA, we have to absolutely make some tough choices. We chose to take risk, first of all, on things that were on the bubble about their executability. If they didn't look like they could really perform well, they were more on the chopping block. That's always true, but I would say we had to particularly focus there. And then we also had to focus on things that wouldn't normally, you know, we don't expect to deliver until the 2030s. I think we've made acceptable choices there. If we get top line growth in the out years, I've been very clear, even when I rolled out the budget, that our strategy depends on that. We've laid that in our fit up. But if we were to look at not a 1 year capped down at 24 and 25, but a continuing cap, that would be a problem for us. We also need supplemental funding. The Department of Defense has always required for operational purposes, whatever you want to call it, OCO, supplemental, reset funding, in order to replenish and reset ourselves and to make up for the operational costs that are over and above what we're doing. Those are resource needs that we have. But I don't think fundamentally our issue is about top line. I care a lot about top line. You can't be the deputy secretary and not care about top line. I think we've advocated very, very well for the resources we need. I think that's part of it, but the predictability, you know, a bird in hand is worth two in the bush. I have no birds in hand, and we have not for a long time. I could do a lot with appropriations at the top line at the FRA level that I just can't do if we spent six more months arguing what the right top line is.
Yeah.
So I just don't want the top line argument to get out of proportion to the reality that we just need resources to operate under.
Okay, I'm getting the stop sign. I'm going to offer one question to the audience and ignore the stop sign. all right, over here, Val. She got her hand up quickly there.
Hi, Valerie Ansona with Breaking Defense. Thank you for taking my question. So it's been about 2 years since you and Secretary Austin hosted CEOs from all of the various hypersonic companies, you know, big and small, at the Pentagon, and imparted a message about how urgent it was that companies needed to move more quickly so that, you know, there were systems that could be fielded, get those into production. And, you know, 2 years later, we still haven't seen that. So why, you know, what happened? And whose fault is this? Is industry not moving fast enough? Or is the congressional yo-yo dieting? Is that constraining the DOD's ability to sort of move as fast on these critical programs as needed? What's going wrong here?
Sure. So I don't think I'd characterize our meeting that way. We were very focused and remain very focused on hypersonic defense. And that I think you had Heidi Shu here today. Yeah. I don't know if you got into this with Heidi, but her devious mind, blessedly, is working this problem very hard. And I'll leave it at that. So that was really part of the focus. Also, we have had success. We've had success in systems like Arrow. The Army has had success, and now the question really is, what makes sense to integrate to the concepts that we have? And I think I'd leave my answer with that final thought, which is the way in which the Chinese, for example, or the Russians use hypersonic weapons is not how we would use hypersonic weapons. The Russians, in fact, have used hypersonic weapons to very little effect in Ukraine. And I do think that's a good example of how we can get overly exercised in an arms race mentality around new system use. Not that those technologies aren't relevant. We obviously are invested in hypersonics ourselves. We have a program we want to pursue, but we're pursuing it in advance, in order to advance the warfighter concepts that we have out there, not to their own end. And I do think we are on plan to do that. Resourcing will make a big difference.
With that, we'll conclude. Please join me in thanking the Deputy Secretary for joining us here today.
The entire National Security Innovation Based Summit program can be found on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Reagan Foundation, including the program focusing on the National Security Innovation Based Report Card. The report card provides grades in 10 different areas, from defense modernization to talent base, with overall marks ranging from A to F. It then provides a set of recommendations for improvement so that the U.S. can get on more efficient footing to combat its geopolitical foes. The lowest grade, an F, was bestowed upon the government for failing to provide sufficient and stable funding for new technologies. The highest grade was an A-, and it was bestowed for innovation leadership. To find a listing of all upcoming events, including the events held by our institute, please visit reaganfoundation.org/events. Thank you for listening.
For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit reaganfoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.